This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight.
We have always been worried about any case reaching Goma. It's a very busy city of close to 2 million people, and it's the gateway to not simply to Rwanda, but it's also an important travel hub to the rest of the country.
That's WHO spokeswoman Margaret Harris on the implications of Ebola cases in Goma. Details coming up also. Talks on forming a transitional government in Sudan is still going on. And a court in Uganda has sentenced activist and academic Dr. Stella Nyanzi to 18 months in prison. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, the World Health Organization acknowledges that a fourth case of Ebola in the eastern Congolese city of Goma is a worrisome development and complicates efforts to get the complex epidemic under control. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
So far, two people have died of Ebola in Goma, the capital of North Kivu province in the Democratic Republic of Congo. The first person, a pastor who became infected with the deadly virus in Butembo, an epicenter of the epidemic, died in mid-July. Earlier this week, a second person, a minor, who traveled from Ituri province to Goma, died. The World Health Organization confirms the man's wife and his one-year-old daughter have tested positive for Ebola. WHO spokeswoman Margaret Harris tells VOA, "The man had spent some time with his family and within the community before he began showing symptoms of the disease." So she says the new cases have not come as a surprise. They were expected. She speaks by phone from Beni.
We have always been worried about any case reaching Goma. It's obviously not a city that you want to have Ebola in. It's a very busy city of close to 2 million people, and it's the gateway to not simply to Rwanda, but it's also an important travel hub to the rest of the country of Congo, and it's got international flights as well.
Harris says health workers have identified more than 200 people who may have come in contact with the minor. She says they are being monitored and vaccinated against the disease. She says investigations are ongoing to trace more people who may have come in contact with the deceased. Besides that, she says all the sites which may have been visited by the minor and contacts are being decontaminated. Since the Ebola epidemic was declared 1 year ago, the WHO says there have been more than 2,500 cases, including more than 1,800 deaths. Those include the recent deaths in Goma, as well as two others in June in Uganda. The WHO says operations in Congo's 9 neighboring countries have been scaled up to prepare for the possibility of the spread of the deadly virus into their territories. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Thousands of people marched in Khartoum and other Sudanese cities yesterday to demand justice for those killed in recent protests. The ruling Transitional Military Council acknowledged that its rapid support forces were involved in the shooting deaths of 7 people in the city of El Obeid earlier this week. Despite the tension, talks on forming a transitional government are going ahead, as Naba Muhyiddin reports from Khartoum.
Tens of thousands of protesters marched in Khartoum to pressure the ruling Transitional Military Council to punish the troops accused of killing 4 students in Al Obeid. The shootings took place Monday as the students rallied against shortages in electricity and fuel. On Monday, the TMC said the rapid support forces were not responsible for the killings. The council blamed shadow troops still loyal to the government of ousted President Omar al-Bashir, whom it said want to create instability. On Thursday, however, the council reversed course and said 7 rapid support forces have been arrested for the shootings in Al Obeid and will be put on trial soon. Amjad Farid is a spokesman for Sudan's opposition umbrella group, the Sudanese Professionals Association, or SPA. Fareed said the proposed transitional government to be formed by the TMC and opposition must still investigate the killings.
The announcement of the TMC does not mean anything because the political agreements have already decided that there will be an independent investigation committee that will be formed during the transitional period by the civilian government.
Analyst Al-Fatih Mahmoud thinks the announcement is a positive step. Mahmoud said the TMC's announcement of RSF responsibility is a positive step, as there should be a named force responsible. Mahmoud said it's expected that greater transparency will be sustained and a step toward the agreement will be made, as well as the punishment of all who are guilty. During Thursday marches, four people were killed in Omdurman city and many others injured, as soldiers opened fire on protesters who demanded justice for those killed during the recent Sudanese revolution. Some protesters, like Hadi Imad, are skeptical that the killing of protesters by security forces will ever stop. He said the crimes are repeated and not stopped because of a lack of transparency and the absence of punishment. He says if we consider the TMC's admission to be a step towards accountability, we demand transparent trials and the punishment of the killers. Despite the killings and tension, the TMC and the opposition resumed talks late Thursday under the guidance of African mediators. The sides have already agreed to share power over the next 3 years until elections, although many details still have to be worked out. Naba Muhiddin for VOA News, Khartoum.
The Gambian government has secured a 5-year debt deferral package from India in response to an appeal from the government of President Adama Barrow. Indian President Ramnath Kovind recently visited the West African nation. India has also provided a grant of $500,000. The Gambia is a heavily indebted country, but some Gambian business owners believe that India has a lot to gain from the Gambia given the socio-economic benefits that its businesses secured from the country. Reporter Pandarambai has the story.
Bilateral relations between the Gambia and India have been cordial for years. This has led to the growing presence of Indian businesses in the country. They are engaged in real estate, grocery stores, and private sector development. Trade between the two countries is said to be close to $190 million annually. The Indian President Ramnath Kovind visited three African countries this week, including Benin, Guinea-Conakry, and the Gambia. In a joint press conference with his host, President Barrow, Kovind reaffirmed his government's commitment to helping the Gambia fulfill its development goals.
We have decided to extend assistance of $500,000 in support of skill development. We also agreed to offer training in the fields of judiciary, police, administration, and technical expertise.
For his part, President Barrow decried Gambia's increasing international debt. He says Gambia's high debt burden is causing a loss of money to the state. The former government of Dictator Jammeh had borrowed farming tractors from India. The dictator later turned the tractors as his personal property.
The debt is a big body, and we appeal to India for debt relief. We have discussed that. At least they give us a debt relief for 5 years that will assist Gambia to implement some of our projects. Because we are paying 60% of tax we collect in this country to service our debt.
Some sections of Gambia's business community had a different feeling as far as India's relation with Banjul is concerned. One of them is Ibrahim Amadike Fall. He is the owner of the Sabina Trading Enterprise. Fall says that Indian businesses have outperformed Gambian businesses in the country. He blames the government for what he calls lack of business opportunity and treatment. He says Gambian businesses are often sidelined by the government.
Gambia being such a small market, the market is easily saturated. And these Indians, they have gone to the point where they are almost like forming a mafia group where they can gang up against anybody they want to pull out of the market. They have controlled sectors of the business community and they are boasting about it on Facebook.
Fall went on to explain the sectors of businesses controlled by the Indians.
If you come to the business of building materials, it's controlled by Indians. If you come to the business of mini markets, supermarkets, they are also in full control. When it comes to the castle business also, instead of importing, buying from Gambians, they're coming down and selling here and controlling their own market. It's really difficult.
Fall also says lack of access to bank loans has frustrated Gambian businesses. He called on the Gambian government to ensure that banks provide Gambians flexible and reasonable loan agreements.
Our financial sectors are what is holding us back. We can't compete with them. They get financing from their Exim banks that are very low interest rate and flexibility to give them chance to build up and grow their businesses. But ours is different.
According to Fall, corruption is another problem facing Gambia's business sector. He says foreign business owners are often taxed less than their Gambian colleagues.
The corrupt practices also is holding us back. I've voiced it out a lot. They will give the Indians the sweetheart deals and give Gambians the cutthroat deals. What they want to do is prove to Gambians that they're doing their job, being tough to us, making it difficult for us. But then the Indians, they will do some very dubious stuff.
Fall says some Indian business owners have started exporting labor into the Gambia. He says the Indians hire their own people to run their businesses. He also says they do not pay decent salaries to local Gambian workers. Gambia's Trade Ministry says the government is committed to establishing the appropriate setting for private sector development. It also promises to facilitate trade, investment, and employment in the country. For VOA Africa, this is Pandering by reporting.
Cameroon says the separatist war in its English-speaking regions has made it impossible to complete repairs and construction of public works like schools and roads. Separatist fighters who have vowed to make the regions ungovernable have chased off nearly all contractors and their workers. Mokedwin Kinzeka visited some of the abandoned project sites in the southwest region and filed this report.
A delegation from Cameroon's Ministry of Public Works, heavily guarded by the military, is looking over uncompleted roads in the English-speaking southwest region. Roads where workers had to abandon repairs or construction because of separatist attacks. Are Agbo, a merchant in the town of Menji, says the lack of usable roads has brought local businesses to a standstill, as they are unable to export food to Nigeria and unable to import electronics and car parts from the neighboring states.
I'm appealing to those young men and girls, appealing to them in very the strongest words to make sure that they don't accept to be deceived, because the Fontem Menji road would have been finished by now, but for this crisis. The road to Akwaya, Mafi to Akwaya, they would have started it long ago, but for this crisis.
The government said work on the roads was to be finished by January 2017. But workers fled when separatist fighters began attacking, killing and kidnapping them. Buinda Godlove Nsakabu, the top-ranking official in charge of economic development in the southwest region, says more than 90% of projects to construct schools, hospitals, bridges and other public works have been abandoned.
Some of the contractors have complained that they are not very willing to go to those difficult areas to execute the projects. Every hand must be on deck for us to ensure that by the end of the year, we should have executed these projects to the benefit of the population, and also to encourage the contractors who are partners in development to accelerate the execution of these projects.
The government says only 42 of the 500 projects envisaged for the northwest and southwest regions within the past 2 years have been carried out. Emmanuel Ngome, an educator in the town of Kumba, says those numbers indicate the separatists who vowed to make it impossible for the government to operate in the two regions are succeeding.
There's no life, no thing is actually moving on. Projects have been abandoned. The contractors have all fled away. They're running for their lives. At this moment, it's a standstill totally. You see nothing, no business. You see empty houses, ghost streets, and everything has been abandoned totally. People have been kidnapped. It's every day.
The crisis in Cameroon's two English-speaking regions began in 2016 when teachers and lawyers protested the overbearing use of the French language in the bilingual country. More than 2,000 people, including soldiers and police, have been killed in mounting violence since. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Kumba, Southwest Cameroon.
The government of Zimbabwe says the Zimbabwe Electricity Supply Authority is easing the country's power crisis by providing an additional 300 megawatts during off-peak hours. As a result, there's been a drop in the hours of load shedding. Retondo Maweri reports from Harare.
Speaking this week during a post-cabinet briefing with the media, Information, Publicity and Broadcasting Services Minister Monica Mtshangwa said the additional 300 megawatts was coming from the Southern African power pool.
ZESA is now accessing 300 megawatts during off-peak hours. This additional power is availed through the Southern African power pool day-ahead market under a US $2 million facility which was mobilized by ZETDC from its own resources. This additional power has reduced the duration of load shedding nationally in most areas.
Mtshangwa said there were also negotiations between the Zimbabwe Electricity and Distribution Company and South Africa's Eskom to unlock a further 400 megawatts. Makomborero Aruzivishe, a Merrick Park resident, says the reduction of load shedding hours makes a difference. Now he can do his chores early.
Yesterday, they came around 9 when they were supposed to come at 10. Of course, in our area of light, it means I can cook my supper earlier, I can even iron earlier, then I can even sleep early.
Another resident, Tawanda Karombo, says he only notices a small change.
There has been a slight improvement in terms of the durations of the load shedding, because I used to go to sleep, there would be no electricity, you wake up, there would be no electricity, but now, like 2 days, 3 days, the duration is only slightly improved.
However, for Mary Msavingana, this improvement is meaningless. Musavingana says she would prefer to have electricity during peak hours, which is when she does her business.
That they've reduced the load shedding during off-peak hours doesn't change our lives in any way. We want and we have to work during the day and sleep during the night. So there's no change in terms of load shedding to us because we will be sleeping.
The Southern African Power Pool is a cooperative arrangement between the national electricity companies in Southern Africa with SADC's support. Under the deal, the members of SAP have created a common power grid between the countries and a common market for electricity in the region. Reporting from Harare, this is Rutendo Mawere.
A court in Uganda has sentenced activist and academic Dr. Stella Nyanzi to 18 months in prison. The government found her guilty of cyber harassment for a Facebook post in which she allegedly insulted President Museveni and his late mother. Nyanzi has been in prison since November. She will serve the sentence for 9 months, since she has already served half before being convicted. During the sentencing, which was read out via video conferencing, Nyanzi was seen on a screen from prison stripping her breast bare in protest. Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala.
According to the court, former Makerere University research fellow and activist Stella Nyanzi committed the crime of cyber harassment with a vulgar posting on Facebook that targeted President Yoweri's mother, Esther Kokundeka. The poem was posted on Nyanzi's social media pages on the 16th of September 2018, a day after Museveni celebrated his 74th birthday. Although she had earlier been charged with two offences, the court acquitted her of offensive communication and upheld the charge of cyber harassment. The court
was presided over by Magistrate Gladys Kamasanyu. She said the prosecution had enough evidence to charge Nyanzi for cybercrime.
An average person applying contemporary community standards would find that the whole post lacks serious literary, artistic, political, educational, or even scientific value. It does not in any way communicate any sensible message. The post cannot be discussed openly in any contemporary society in this country or outside this country. To the young generation, it corrupts their minds. It is not acceptable in any form of society. The post is very disgusting. It is obscene. It is indecent. It is lewd.
Evidence tabled in court included exhibits such as activation codes used to create Nyanzi's Facebook account and documents showing the number that activated the account. However, Nyanzi, who became the first person to be convicted under the Computer Misuse Act, said she was more interested in being charged with offensive communication since it involved President Museveni.
I planned to offend Yoweri Museveni Kaguta because he has offended us for 30 plus years and we are silent. Find me guilty of cyber harassment. Find me guilty of anything else, but please find me guilty of offensive communication against Yoweri Museveni Kaguta. Because that is what serious mothers in Uganda should be doing. We are tired of the dictatorship.
Nyanzi, who has been incarcerated since last year, says she is ready to stay in prison to fight what she terms Uganda's dictatorial regime.
My children do not deserve a mother who is silent. I refuse to be silent in the face of oppression, in the face of dictatorship. I will sacrifice motherhood to whatever altar I have to sacrifice motherhood to.
Isaac Semakade is Nyanzi's lawyer. He says the court ruling has exposed the lack of judicial independence in Uganda.
We predicted a loss here, and it is what has happened. The result in this case was predetermined a long time ago from somewhere. We've seen our own judiciary permit itself to be a theater for politicized abuse of political and judicial power. Sometime in the fullness of time, we will be able to clean up this mess. History will absolve Dr. Stella Nyanzi, and Uganda shall be free and safe again.
Many have viewed Nyanzi's conviction as a huge blow to freedom of expression as enshrined in the Ugandan constitution. Joan Nyanyuchi, Amnesty International's director for East Africa, the Horn, and the Great Lakes responded to the charges against Nyanzi. In a statement, she challenged Uganda's authorities to scrap the Computer Misuse Act 2011, which has been used systematically to harass, intimidate, and stifle government critics. Stella Nyanzi has been repeatedly harassed, arrested, and detained for her social media posts against the Museveni regime. In January, she told a High Court judge that she suffered a miscarriage while at Luzira Prison. In February, the University of Makerere terminated her employment, which was suspended in 2016. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
The bodies of another 20 migrants who drowned last week when their boat capsized in the Mediterranean have washed ashore in the Libyan town of Qoms. An estimated 150 refugees died in the disaster and a total of 75 bodies have been recovered. Most of the refugees are from sub-Saharan Africa. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Dan Brown, and our engineer, Nick Ivanov, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time,
with David Bandy.
Hello, sports fans. This is the voice of America's Sonny Young.
please join me Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC for the sunny side of sports. On Fridays, you can also hear my expanded 30-minute edition of the show at 17:30 UTC, right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America.